All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's episode of A Whole Lot of Gray. My guest today is a good friend of mine, Rahul Rai, who is a managing partner at Gamma Point Capital, which is a crypto hedge fund specializing in market neutral strategies. For those of you confused with all this jargon, we'll be going over what this all means throughout the conversation. But fun fact, Gamma Point Capital was in the news recently for being acquired by BlockTower, another crypto hedge fund in the space, for a whopping $35 million. That's some serious bank right there. BlockTower, fun fact, is actually backed by Mark Lasry. My bad if I'm mispronouncing his name, but he's actually the co-owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. So we got some indirect NBA connects up in here. But jokes aside, Rahul's only 23 years old. And look, at any stage in life, if you're exiting an idea you had in your head for millions of dollars, I think that's just nothing short of an incredible accomplishment, even more so when you're 23. And if I understand correctly, Rahul actually turns 24. Probably by the time the audio version of this episode is out, Rahul will be 24. So happy birthday in advance. I hope this is a good birthday gift, right? And congratulations, and thank you for joining the show, man. I'm very excited for this episode.
Thanks so much, Anish. Great to be on and looking forward to catching up with you.
Yeah, likewise. So just quick thing before we get into it. Is this your podcast debut or no?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad it is. I'm so glad it is, obviously, because we're friends. And more importantly, I feel like as Gamma Point Capital grows, more and more podcasts are going to want to start hearing what you have to say. So I'm glad I got first dibs, you know. But yeah, jokes aside, let's jump right into it. So kind of walk my listeners through your story. How did this all start?
Yeah. So I've always essentially just loved finance. So studied finance at the Wharton School where I did my undergrad. And around like my sophomore year or so, I really started diving deep into just the math behind financial economics and really just went down that rabbit hole and kind of got immersed in it. And so knew pretty early on that I wanted to get into quant finance and macro trading, that kind of stuff. And so post-graduation, I got a job at Morgan Stanley on their currency trading desk. And that was a very cool experience. I was kind of in the center of Wall Street, covering a lot of the largest macro hedge funds and quant funds. And so I was introduced to crypto markets in early 2020 by my co-founder, Sanat. And so he had just quit. He was a partner at a VC firm, and he had just quit to launch this crypto fund. And he was trying to get me kind of excited about the space. And so as we kind of looked at just the crypto market structure together, we immediately realized that it was highly inefficient. And primarily just because it's very driven by retail speculative traders, and there aren't a lot of institutional funds stepping in to add efficiency and arbitrage kind of these easy opportunities. And so that's been our focus as a fund. But also just kind of to add to that, as I went down the whole crypto rabbit hole, I also started to just really, from an intellectual perspective, just appreciate the value and innovation behind these cryptocurrencies and decentralized technologies. And so a lot of kind of the broader goal of, so the broader theme is called decentralized finance. And its real goal is to democratize finance and rebuild all financial services on the blockchain and just really open up access to capital markets for globally, right, for everyone. And so it's a really kind of grand mission and a lot of really cool innovation happening that got me just really excited about the space.
Wow. Yeah. No, thank you for that. I think that's pretty accurate, right? And pretty succinct as well. So one thing which, you know, before we get into the specifics of what you do, you said that, you know, and my understanding based on whatever, you know, I've spoken to you and the research I've done, the Gamma Point Capital's kind of USP, kind of the market gap you guys are filling is, hey, listen, we're specializing in market neutral strategies. And something which maybe a lot of other crypto funds in the space are not doing. So for my listeners, imagine they're complete laywomen and laymen. Explain what market neutral strategies are. Why are they beneficial?
Yeah. So market neutral strategy is essentially a strategy that's generating consistent returns month on month across different market regimes. And so our strategies, their performance is completely uncorrelated to the broader crypto market. And so Bitcoin could be up 80% or down 60%, and that doesn't really affect us or our strategies. So we're earning just consistent return across these environments. And so very simple, just to give you guys a kind of a feel for the strategies we're running. So a very simple market neutral arbitrage strategy would be buying and selling Bitcoin that's mispriced on different exchanges. So for example, if Bitcoin was trading at 50K on Coinbase and 55K on Binance, a different exchange, you could buy it for 50K on Coinbase, transfer it to Binance, and then sell it for 55K and capture right. that $5,000 spread without any market price risk, assuming you could do that fast enough. And so that's like a very, very simple trade. Those kind of opportunities don't exist anymore because the markets are a lot more efficient than that. But that's kind of a feel for the flavor of strategies we're deploying. So we're usually capturing spreads between different instruments, and we're agnostic about the direction they're moving in. We're just capturing the relative spread between the two.
Right. Nice. No, very, very solid explanation, right? So it's kind of like, regardless of the volatility, regardless of a downward or upward fluctuation, you guys are trying to make up that balance kind of that exists, right? So yeah, that's pretty solid. I believe that is a very valuable market gap, and clearly Block Tower thought so as well, right? So yeah, it certainly is cool. One thing, right, before we delve more into this kind of stuff, would you know, you've been at Wharton, you've been at Morgan Stanley after. So even before this venture of yours, you've spent just so much of your adult life in the finance space, right? Did you notice, you know, throughout that, wow, a lot of my peers are severely lacking in financial literacy and financial knowledge? Or did you think, no, everyone's pretty well aware about these things?
Yeah, I think people are definitely pretty lacking, including myself and like people from Wharton as well, right? Because a lot of the stuff you study or even do on a day-to-day job is very different from managing your own personal portfolio, right?
And absolutely.
I think people underestimate the power of compounding, the power of diversification. And so I think most people are pretty ill-informed there. Just I think being smart about how you manage your money in your portfolio and how you're growing wealth over time is sometimes a lot more important than even just how much you've accumulated, right? Because if you're smart about how you're managing it, that's kind of, to me, longer term, what pays out more.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's kind of like a rich dad, poor dad approach, right? It's make the money work for you, and it's how you manage the money more than, oh, okay, how much you've accumulated or how much income you're making, right?
Just the power of compounding, right? Because if fun fact, if you're compounding at a 7% annualized growth rate, in 10 years, you're going to double your money, right? Which is pretty insane. 7% a year is kind of the well below the average S&P return. And so if you're just smart about how you're growing your money, it can compound pretty fast. And most people don't appreciate that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think these are all, you know, facts that everyone, not just people looking to start their own crypto hedge fund, need to hear, right? This is anyone managing any sort of, you know, wealth, looking to, you know, grow their financial empires, if you will. Also, just out of curiosity, you said 7% as an example is well below the median return. What would you say the median or mean return typically is?
That's probably like exactly what the median return for the S&P is.
Nice.
The median's probably higher because the median's a lot higher, but then the S&P has a lot of downside fat tails, right? And so that's actually probably exactly close to the mean. So it's like 8%.
Nice.
Kind of, if you're US equities, that's probably how much you're going to return. Yeah.
All right. That ballpark, basically.
Yeah.
Nice. Very cool. So one thing, you know, is, and I spoke to you about this before, you know, before we did this episode, that you're gonna, you know, a lot of people now are gonna be like, oh, wow, Rahul's a legend. He, you know, made it, did this and that. He's had an idea in his head and, you know, got acquired. Like I said, like A to Z, I'm simplifying it a lot, but that is kind of what 90% of people, especially in our generation, are seeking. So it's kind of like you've gotten this elixir now, right? That a lot of people are yearning, But I also told you this before, 99% of those people are completely unaware of the behind the scenes stuff, right? Of the commitment, the dedication, just the manic obsession, right? That it would have taken you guys to kind of get here. So kind of walk me and my listeners a bit through that. Like, what did the behind the scenes grind look like? What was your process and routine between point A, which is meeting Sanath at this party in Bangalore, and actually getting acquired now by Block Tower? What did that whole timeline look like?
Yeah, so first of all, there's kind of, we had no idea this was going to happen, right? And I'll walk you through the story, but so essentially how I viewed it, right, and how we viewed it is that, number one, we found this really good market opportunity that we realized that we were doing the trade. So initially we thought it was too good to be true. And so we were like doing this trading and we're like, holy shit, this actually works. And then we're like, let's scale this up and see if it works. And then we scale it up and it's working. We're like, holy shit, this is incredible. And then we're like, okay, wow, we can really like this, these strategies could scale. We could raise capital. Like, this could really work out. But it was more like, it was a lot of initial just exploration. We didn't even know what we were going to do. We played around with a bunch of different strategies and they finally stuck. And it was that combined with just like a real obsession and love for the space, right? So the whole DeFi, decentralized finance, that really only took off in like June, July of last year. So pretty recent phenomena, and just kind of really on top of the space and kind of immersed in it just because we were intellectually curious, right? And now a lot of our strategies are leveraging some of those protocols. And so I think it was a combination of just realizing that there's this niche that actually we're really good at that's really exciting. And also just kind of intellectually just being in love with the ecosystem. So just being on top of everything that was coming out and just, and hence naturally immersing yourself, right? So it was never really like work. It was more like, in all my free time, this is essentially all I'm doing and reading about, right? This is what excites me. This is what I'm curious about. And it becomes like very immersive. But we always viewed it as we wanted to first test it on our own capital. And then if that worked, then scale it up to an actual hedge fund. So then actually raise external capital and raise a hedge fund. And so we went through that process, and then starting the hedge fund was way tougher than you can imagine. So we were doing that early 2021, and it's there's all these legal compliance stuff you have to go through. Like, you have to set up bank accounts, entities. And it was a huge nightmare, but it was also just a great learning experience. And then once that was done, we just started kind of fundraising for the fund. And that was pretty much, that kind of consumed my time through like Feb, March, and even April of this year. And so we're just doing a lot of fundraising. Basically every day we had like four or five calls with potential investors. Nice. And then the deal kind of just happened very naturally. So Block Tower was looking, they were excited by the market neutral opportunity, and they were considering launching their own fund, but they just didn't really have the in-house expertise to do that. And so they realized that it made sense to bring someone in if they could. And I had actually been connected to, so one of my friends from Morgan Stanley, his roommate was a head trader at Block Tower. And so it was kind of just like a coincidence that I was connected with him, and then just kind of worked out from there. But we were definitely not looking, we did not, like 6 months ago, there's no way I could have foreseen this. And it was really just very natural. The real takeaways for me are just kind of doing what you love obsessively and just really like networking and just meeting a lot of people. Cause a lot of the success we had came from just people around us who helped us a lot. And a lot of it was just being in the right place at the right time.
Wow. No, I I hope all my listeners are listening to pretty much everything you said in that description, because who better to, cause Raul's not saying it as, okay, he took like an entrepreneurship class at Wharton, and this is what he's telling you, right? Like, this is something for all my listeners. Rahul is telling you a very, very firsthand experience. So thank you for that. I want to touch upon something you said, you know, which I've strongly believed for a long time. I want to get your thoughts on. You said the value of networking, right? Is it safe to draw the conclusion that generally people bet on people, right? Is that safe to say, or is that kind of a stretch? Is that kind of romanticized in the startup space?
No, I think it's one of the most powerful tools, and you're exactly right, right? Humans trust other humans and bet on people they're close to. And so even in like my personal story, all of it was just through random networks, right? So I met Sunith at a party and we just really hit it off. And the other co-founder was my good friend from Penn. His name's Ish, and he was like, he's our CTO. And again, he's just a good friend I had known for a while. And so the three of us kind of got together, and then all of like our investors were pretty much just like either friends or friends of friends. And even with this deal happening, like we are again connected through like a friend or a friend of friend. And so I think networking is super important. And what it really boils down to is just building good connections in an area that you're interested in and with other people who are interested in the same kind of field, right? And it just makes sense. If you're passionate about something, you want to kind of know other people and be involved with other people who are passionate about it, because they're probably doing cool stuff, you're doing cool stuff, and there's usually always some way that you can both help each other. And so, yeah, I'm never a believer in like, so in business school, there's kind of like networking sessions and events, and that's a lot more formal and forced. And I always hated that. But to me, right, what it networking really means, and I did this a lot, especially early when I was into crypto, is just reaching out to people and just being like, this is what I'm doing. I'm super passionate. I want to learn, and kind of connecting with people that way in a very genuine way.
Right. No, I think that's facts, man. And I think one thing that you said earlier kind of ties into this, which is, you know, you said, oh yeah, and in addition to everything else, we were at the right place at the right time. But hey, I mean, you guys put yourself out there to be in the right place at the right time. You know what I mean? It's not like God came with this wand and was like, oh, okay, I like Sunath and Rahul, so I'm gonna put them coincidentally in this point in time where all the stars align, right? And I think, like you said, just put your name out there, talk to as many people who are, you know, have similar interests, similar focus as you do, and you never know what could happen. That's solid, man. And I'm glad to hear that, because I've always been a big believer that people bet on people. So it's good to hear that. And that's also one thing, just real quick, you know, even at, I feel like in most American universities, right, they have these, you know, networking sessions and career nights and things like that, right? And often it feels like you're on a forced date, right? If anything else, like you just have to make this good impression. It's, you don't know what you can say, what you can't say, right? How would you go about, you know, because so a lot of people listening, right? I think 2/3 of my demographic is kind of in their early 20s, right? So I would go out on a limb and assume that they'll be entering the cycle of networking events and stuff, obviously after the pandemic fully wraps up. So what advice would you give to people attending networking events on kind of, hey, if they feel, hey, listen, this is too formal of an environment for me, right? I can't be myself. What advice would you give to people to kind of navigate that?
Yeah. I mean, my advice is, so first of all, it sucks, right? I hate it. I don't think anyone likes it. But I would say just do it. It's definitely number one. It actually helps. Like even I did a consulting internship that I didn't really like, but I got it. A lot of it was just through networking, right? And so when you make these connections, it matters. It helps you get the interview. When people can put a face to the resume, that really helps you kind of accelerate the interview process. And so I'd say it sucks, but it's treated as like a learning experience. It's like going to the gym, right? Most people don't like it, but you got to do it. And you kind of can only grow from it. So yeah, I'd say, and yeah, kind of just prepare questions. And the more you do it, the more you get used to it. So like, if I were to do it now, I mean, I've done so many that I could do it, right? And it wouldn't be a problem. But it's definitely a useful skill set to learn, right? Even like, just like going on an awkward first date there's a lot to learn from that, right? In terms of communication, dealing with tough situations. I'd say don't shy away from it. There's some people who reject it because they don't like it. And that's just kind of shying away from your fears or challenges, right? So I'd say—
Which is never great, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so even though it's a shitty situation, just do it because it helps. It'll help you get the job if you want the job, and it'll also just help you grow.
Yeah, very, very true, man. Very true. And I couldn't have put it better myself. If you're avoiding a networking event, the only reason should be, okay, you don't think this networking event will provide you enough value. You know what I mean? Not, oh, okay, I'm uncomfortable, so I'll stay in my comfort zone, right? Yeah. So I think the gym analogy is so spot on. Yeah, it's like, given the choice, most people don't love it, but you kind of have to do it to level up, right? So I feel you on that. I definitely feel you on that. So now, you know, you're, you know, kind of, you know, going forward, you and Block Tower, along with your other two co-founders, I think, you know, obviously have a big, big, big journey ahead of you guys. And I wish you guys the very best, first of all. And one thing is, as you guys go on this journey, we're going to enter a world, especially I'm sure in the US, where, you know, more and more such ventures are going to pop up, right? Where they're going to want to get into the crypto game. But you also see countries like India and a lot of countries in Asia, which kind of have an aversion to adopting crypto, even allowing the free flow of cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this aversion? Why do you think they are averse, right? And do you see this changing in the future?
Yeah. So I think there are two main reasons why governments are averse, right? So the first is just that they realize that they're losing control, right? Because if you have a monetary system that's outside of your control, you can't monitor it, you can't control it. And especially like if you think about the US, right, the role that the Fed provides and the central bank provides is to maintain financial stability, right?
Right.
By controlling monetary policy and interest rates. And
right.
If there's an entire financial system happening outside of your control, you no longer have that control, right?
Right.
And so from that perspective, I actually get it. That makes sense to me. The right. other thing though is that a lot of these governments and regulators don't fully understand it, right? And I don't blame them for not understanding it, but I blame them for kind of making big decisions while not fully understanding it, right?
That's
and
so true.
It's not easy stuff to comprehend, like even just how blockchain technology works, how Bitcoin works, right? If you just go read the white paper, it's really complicated. Like it took me a while to wrap my head around it. How distributed consensus works, like how cryptocurrencies works, the cryptography behind it, all of this it's not trivial stuff, right? And so for someone to fully understand, so almost anyone I've met who actually understands this, right, who's spent the time to understand the underlying economics, technology, game theory behind this, they love the space, right? And it's rare for someone who gets it to not be bullish on it. And so I think the other issue is just like education, right? It's tough for people to understand. And so they're like, okay, this is something we kind of get, seems weird. And also we can't control, so let's shut it down. But where I see some promise or some potential is, I think eventually central banks, and they've already been toying with this idea of a central bank digital currency. So it's CBDC for short. And so it's essentially a cryptocurrency issued by central banks that they can then regulate, monitor, and control. And so I think that to me is like a good intermediary step of bridging this world of centralized finance and decentralized finance. And that kind of really meets in the middle. So I think I'm pretty bullish on that. I think that's the path that some of these countries, especially the US and China, I think within the next 5 years, I'd be pretty surprised if that's not the path they went down. And I kind of see that as a good middle ground.
Yeah, no, that's, I hope you're right. It's definitely an optimistic outlook, and the analysis is spot on, because it kind of goes back to what you said earlier, right? Look, people are afraid of what they don't know. That's just a fact, right? The unknown is like the scariest thing for human beings. So, and I mean, look, if you're saying you took a while to, you know, kind of wrap your head around how these things work, it certainly took me a while to fully understand. And I mean, I would still say there's a lot, obviously, I don't know, but to even get to a nascent level of understanding of how blockchain tech works, of the, you know, how mining these things actually work, the fact that there's a finite supply, you can't mine unlimited coins the same way you can't mine unlimited gold, right? The fact that these, to even get to this point, it took me a while as well, but kind of like networking, right? Just bite the bullet and do it. Like if you fully understand, or if you understand crypto to a reasonable level, and then you go like, okay, I'm averse to this, I feel like that's better, no, than going like, oh, okay, this is big and scary, I don't want to attempt to understand this, right? And I completely agree with you that governments are just dismissing it and making big, big, big policy decisions without, you know, fully understanding what's going on. So one thing in addition, just while we're on this topic, right, I don't want to, you know, mince any words or anything, but a lot of, how do I say this, illicit, you know, black market stuff is financed through crypto, right? I mean, that's just pretty much a reality, ranging from getting a fake ID in college, right, which is one of the more innocent ones, to obviously crazy stuff that goes down on the dark web. A lot of this is financed through crypto. As crypto, you know, becomes the norm, I guess, going forward, and the fact that its sex appeal in a way is that, okay, it's decentralized, the government doesn't have its paws all over it. How do we ensure that, you know, the people playing with crypto are not the guys financing dark web activities? Or is that a concern you think we haven't figured out how to deal?
Yeah, so my first reaction to that would just be that I think it's just like a side effect of crypto, right? When you're, okay, if you want decentralization and you want a censorship, government-free currency and financial system, money laundering and black money is going to be a side effect of that. Just like if you want the internet, right, and connecting computers across the world, you're going to have all kinds of weird shit come up, right? With like,
right,
porn, dark web, all of that, right? And right, so it's just a side effect of the core. The core thesis is that you want it to be censorship resistant. And so money laundering fits perfectly into that. But I think how most people in the space view it is that there's so much amazing stuff being built and so much value being created that the side effect of money laundering happening through crypto is just kind of not that relevant. While it is, it can still happen, there's so many other benefits and so much value being created outside of that.
Right. No, I feel you.
Yeah, so that's really how I view it. And just like with the internet, there's so many like bad and nefarious things that you can also do now that with internet, but the benefits clearly outweigh the
cost.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. Is it safe to say, hey, listen, I think the internet is actually a very good analogy. So is it safe to say, hey, listen, just because, you know, people are using the internet to traffic, you know, illicit drugs and humans and child porn and all these awful things, doesn't mean you shouldn't use Gmail, right? Like, doesn't mean you shouldn't use all the other positive things the internet has to offer you. No, I do definitely agree with that. I think it is going to be interesting, though, as we, you know, kind of move into the crypto future, how all these different stakeholders, like regulators, people in the crypto space, you know, and obviously, you know, traders and funds like yourself, kind of figure out, oh, okay, how do we navigate the bad stuff and ensure that people are getting only the good parts of the pie? I think that's going to be a very interesting discussion. And I hope BlockTower is at the forefront of that discussion. Yeah. So definitely.
Just one thing to add to that is like, yeah, so for regulators, the whole money laundering thing is just a low hanging fruit that they can dangle in front of everyone to, because as we discussed, there are a lot of other reasons why they're apprehensive. And so this is the easiest one to bring up because everyone gets it, right? And it's kind of true. Right. But a lot of money laundering happens with US dollars, right? Like all of drug dealing, like you're not going to ban US dollars, right? So, it's just an easy, to me, it's just like an easy way to mobilize negative sentiment around the ecosystem.
Yeah. No, very true, very true. And I feel like, look, one thing government loves doing is if it has an agenda, I feel like the easiest way for governments to carry out the agenda, any government around the world, is to fearmonger, right? That's just a fact. And I think, like you said, this is low-hanging fruit that they can really instill fear in people. It's like, oh, look, you know, do you want to trade in crypto, that thing that's financing all this terrorism and stuff? And you're like, okay, obviously that's not what, you know, majority of crypto is about, but go off. I agree with you. So one thing, right, is kind of like, you know, we spoke about how a lot of people, even at spaces you're from, right, like the Whartons and the Morgan Stanleys of the world, a lot of people even that inhabit those spheres maybe are not the most, you know, financially literate or financially knowledgeable, right? So you can imagine how everyone else is then. But jokes aside, I feel like that if people are, you know, severely lacking in traditional finance knowledge, they're definitely severely lacking in crypto knowledge, right? So is that something which is on BlockTower's agenda or a Gamma Points agenda, which is kind of dishing out, you know, content to inform people like, hey, listen, don't be afraid of it. This is kind of what we're about, right? Is that on the cards or is that not a space you guys are trying to get into?
No, 100%. That's something I've even just personally done. So I have a blog. I'll share the link with you after. But I've published a lot of content and I've written about decentralized finance, why it's good, what you can do, how it's disrupting traditional finance. And yeah, I think the best way to educate people is through content, right? And that's what really, that's how I got into this space, right? It was just a lot of, just a ton of reading, and just, there's some really good pieces that even now kind of like shape my view of the space. And so that's definitely something that, like, I think we prioritize as a fund. And I also just personally just really care about. Yeah.
No, very solid, very solid. Also, to all listeners, I'll be inserting the link to Rahul's blog in the description as well. Check it out. I'm sure you learn a thing or two, you know, definitely about finance and crypto, that kind of stuff. But yeah, definitely. I'm glad. I'm looking forward, because I do think, you know, digital content is also the future in a way, like crypto is, right? Like conversations like the one me and you are having, dare I say, will actually go a long way for even just a few people. So the one thing about Bitcoin, like you said, which is kind of the, you know, hottest and most common, definitely not the hottest, but you know, the most commonly you know, talked about cryptocurrency. I feel like the thing about Bitcoin, right, is it's obviously super fickle. It's subject to a lot of volatility, right? So I feel like a concern is, let's say there are three buckets of people, right? One bucket of people are, you know, super super clueless, super unaware about cryptocurrency and finance, right? Then there's a second bucket, which kind of gets it, right? But it's still apprehensive. And then you have the third bucket, which is people like yourself and Block Tower, which get it and are trying to leverage the value as much as possible.
Yeah.
So I want to tackle the second bucket, which is the intermediate bucket, if you will, kind of people who kind of get it, but are still apprehensive. I feel like a lot of people are, those people are apprehensive because of the volatility that surrounds cryptocurrencies, right? A lot of people have voiced to me ahead of this episode that, okay, like if Elon tweets something, you know, the price fluctuates and there's a lot of potential manipulation going on. How do we, you know, A, tell people, okay, yes, that sort of volatility does exist, but that's not a reason you should completely shy away from that. And does, you know, is Block Tower / Gamma Point doing something to kind of inform its clientele about, hey, listen, we got you covered all angles, regardless of the volatility?
Yeah. So I'd say, like, so in finance theory, the kind of the most basic concept is risk return, right? So, and in any efficient market, you're not going to get return. If you're trying to look for higher return, you need to take on higher risk, right? And risk in form of price volatility. And so with Bitcoin, the return potential is incredible, right? It could,
right,
could easily 5x from here. And with that kind of asymmetric upside payout, I think the volatility is a very fair compensation, right? And I still think on a risk-adjusted basis, it's still such an attractive investment. And so I think for people, what they should kind of, how they should think about it is, okay, this could potentially 5x or 10, say 10x from here. At the same time, there's significant volatility, 50% drawdowns are pretty common. There's a chance I could lose all my money. So how much of my portfolio would I be comfortable putting in this kind of asset, right? And so it's not a binary decision. If you are averse to risk and volatility, you put a much smaller percent of your portfolio in it. If you're pretty indifferent, and so the younger you are, the less averse you should be to volatility, because you kind of just care about returns, because in the long run, that's what's going to compound. So if you're younger and more risk-taking, it makes sense to have it as a broader part of your portfolio. But at Gamma Point, what we do as a market neutral fund is we completely hedge out this volatility, right? So the whole thesis, where our whole selling point is that we are just finding inefficiencies in the crypto market structure and not exposing our investors to any price volatility correlated to crypto markets. And so that's really our selling point. But at the same time, in my personal account, I'm very long crypto, right? And for me, it's kind of, I view it as like there's such an asymmetric upside potential here that's not at all priced in. And so I'm willing to ride the volatility because I'm thinking about this in a 5 to 10 year time horizon.
Right. It's a marathon, not a sprint, essentially, right? So
yeah, yeah. And no. Yeah, I think as we see it getting more institutionalized, as larger institutional investors come in, as retail speculators kind of play a less important role in the broader crypto markets, we're going to see volatility subdue over time. I think any nascent technology is going to start out pretty volatile, but as it becomes more institutionalized, I expect that to diminish over time. And we've seen volatility come down versus 2017, 2018 already.
Right. So it kind of, the wheels are already in motion, right, to deal with these sort of things. No, definitely. Very, very solid assessment of the situation, right? So kind of just a couple more things I wanted to get your thoughts on. And I, like I said, guys, be sure to check out his blog as well after you're done listening to this episode, because like he said, which I completely agree with, this is definitely the future. Okay, so whether or not you want to be on board with it, whether or not you want to hold crypto, you're going to have to be aware of what's going on, right? At least know what's good. And one thing which Rahul said, which is so true, is there's kind of a way to get a piece of the pie, regardless of whether you're risk averse or if you're, you know, very bullish about these sort of things. It's not a binary. As he said, there's a lot of gray area in the middle, which is what we're about here on A Whole Lot of Gray. So I'm glad we could highlight that. Now, just one thing real quick is, you know, me and you have spoken a bit about this earlier, and anyone who's spoken to me, either my friends in the States or back here in India, know that I'm super excited about NFTs as a concept, right? So which are non-fungible tokens. I'll be adding a couple links in the description as a walkthrough for you guys. But yeah, kind of walk me through, I guess, you know, your thoughts on NFTs. How are they gonna, you know, play out, you think, in the next few years?
Yeah. So before I go into that, I want to caveat that with saying that I definitely am not at all an expert. I don't get art. That's never been one of my skill sets. And so I'm very much kind of giving you my view as an outsider. But at the same time, I'm kind of in tune with just the crypto ecosystem. So I kind of know what's going on. And so what I've seen with NFTs is that basically there's this huge bubble kind of like towards the end of Feb, early March, where you're seeing things getting sold for ridiculous prices, and that kind of is now faded. But really the whole interest around the space is driven by this concept of digital scarcity, right? Mm-hmm. And so at its core, what non-fungible means is that it is a unique digital token that has, you can verify its uniqueness, right? And that's kind of one of the beauty of just, or like one of the beautiful innovations of just blockchain technology, right? You can create these tokens that you can prove and verify that they're unique and scarce, right? And before this, you couldn't. If I showed you a digital image, you could just duplicate it, and there was no way to differentiate between the two. But now you can actually, you can say, hey, no, this one's actually unique. And we can prove that it's unique using cryptography, right?
And if you try recreating it, we're going to come for you, right?
So, yeah, we're going to come for you, or we can all, you can recreate it, but then I can prove that yours is fake.
Very easily.
And so that's one of the, and so if you think about art in the real world, right? So if you have a Picasso painting, I could just duplicate that and honestly make a better version of it, right? But the reason why the Picasso has value is because humans choose to give value to the original, right? So the original is unique and we give it value, even though it might not be the best, even though it might not be the prettiest, even though I could give you 10 different versions where no chance that you would be able to differentiate, but still the one that was the original one is going to be worth more, right? And that's kind of human nature. And so NFTs have now brought this to the digital world where you can now, you can have a digital picture, right? Where again, you can obviously replicate it. It's very easy to replicate digital media, but you can, because it's the unique piece, that's what gives it value. And so that really is a great innovation. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. And that's why the community is so excited about it. And so from my experience, I've seen, it's really cool. I'm now in Miami and we had an event at like this art exhibit, and a lot of like people that you would never expect have even been involved in technology. So a lot of like street painters and like all these kinds of people are now so passionate about NFTs. They're loving it. They're embracing it. And to me, that's a sign that this is kind of a really big deal, right? The fact that like the art community, the music community is really embracing it and using it and advocating for it. To me, that's just like the best kind of validation. And so I think it's here to stay. I think it's going to be in the next 10, 20 years, there's going to be a transformation of art and music and ownership. and NFTs are going to play a big part in that. And yeah, I'm trying to educate myself as much as I can. I still don't fully get a lot of it. I'm like, I've always wanted to like invest in NFTs and trade them, but I just don't have the kind of natural instincts for that. But yeah, I'm just trying to educate myself just like you guys as much as I can.
No, makes sense. And one thing which I think is facts, what you said, right, is it's the one form of crypto which is getting a lot of non-tech, non-finance people excited as well. Like you said, right, at your event in Miami, a lot of artisans, people from the arts and crafts community, if you will, getting excited. Because think about it. Imagine if you could digitally verify that I am holding the first ever Mona Lisa. That would be sick, right? Yeah. So definitely I see why that's happening. And I would urge everybody listening to this. Again, I'm not saying you should spend all your cash on purchasing NFTs, but definitely acquaint yourself with what's going on, because it's kind of this unique marriage of crypto, of tech, finance, and art, all, you know, under the bracket of crypto, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
Also, fun fact, you said, you know, art's never really been your thing. In eighth grade bio class, we had to draw this bacterial cell. And yeah, I'm not even joking, my teacher thought it was a cabbage, my bacterial cell. So yeah,
please don't go around making NFTs. Don't even.
Definitely. Hopefully I'll be the one purchasing them, but yeah, definitely not going to be creating any for sure. Unless you're trying to get a cabbage NFT,
that's,
you know,
true. That's so true. That's a good point.
Definitely. I'll get in on that. No, but yeah, just fun little anecdote that I'm not the most artsy person on the block either.
I'm right,
but
there with
you, know, you. Kind of, Yeah, man. So it's good. It's good. At least we're trying to acquaint ourselves with the non-art part of NFTs, right? So hopefully some value there. Yeah. But yeah, no, definitely good assessment on that. And I would urge everyone, you know, like, and that's something also, before I forget, one thing which I think is a huge takeaway for everybody listening to Rahul right now is humility really is a virtue. Okay. Like, it's so easy for Rahul to say right now, oh yeah, like, here's my thoughts on NFTs, you should take it as gospel, right? Because of the position he's in. But he's not. He's being straight about it. He's keeping it 100, right? Just saying, hey, listen, this is maybe one form of crypto I don't know as much. So everyone just listening, regardless of what you end up doing, just, you know, never get too big for your boots. I think that's one of the coolest things about you, bro. Don't change that. But so one thing, again, you know, kind of just to, you know, I hate it when people say, oh, just to play devil's advocate, but it's kind of essentially what I'm going to do right now, is a lot of people, and especially a lot of the activist community, right, are going to start opposing crypto. I personally think because of, you know, the environmental concerns that come with mining these finite resources, right? How does the crypto community, right, plan on navigating that? Because they're not an easy crowd to deal with, right? Like, the environmental activists, if they believe that, oh, okay, what you're doing is so negative, right, that's not a fun spot to be in. So is this a conversation that the crypto community is talking about, or it's kind of a, we'll cross that bridge when we reach it?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely, it's a really big topic of conversation. And the reason why it became so big was when Elon Musk said that Tesla was no longer going to support Bitcoin because it's bad for the environment, right? And that was really the catalyst, the trigger. My initial thoughts are, again, first of all, I don't have a good understanding of this. I haven't deep dived into the research behind how much energy this is consuming and how bad it is for the environment versus other sorts of kind of like mining and computation. But from my initial reading, it's no worse than literally any other kind of computation, right? Cloud computing, or even mining, right, of like gold or oil or silver,
natural resources,
all of that's terrible for the environment. And so to me, it seems, I think it's true that it is bad for the environment, but I think that there are a lot of things that are bad for the environment, and this is like an easy attack vector again.
Right. And you kind of like what we were talking about with regulation, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's the same, it's the exact same thing where you have to think about the benefits and whether the benefits outweigh the cost, right? And but at the same time, I think that because of like really just driven by Elon Musk, I think there's now been a move for miners to switch to more renewable forms of energy. And so there's now like a Bitcoin Miners Council, and they've like had all these conversations. And I think very soon, I think they plan to transition 50% of the mining to fully renewable sources of energy, which is fantastic, right? And so I think that's kind of the future. So I think because of all of the pressure that they're getting, there is this move to renewable energy sources. And I think that's great, right? Clearly, that's great for the environment. And so I think I only think good things about that. So I think Elon's already said that once that transition's done, he's ready to start accepting it again. And I think that should happen pretty soon.
Very true.
So yeah, I think renewable energy is basically the solution to this problem.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope everyone heard that very carefully, especially, you know, I know I have a couple listeners out in DC, you know, kind of in the think tank government space. If, you know, you're listening to this, right, take exactly that is, yes, there are environmental concerns. Yes, there are regulatory concerns, but so does a lot of other stuff, right? So unless you can prove that, hey, listen, NFTs or cryptocurrencies are way worse for the environment or are way more likely to lead to money laundering and all these illicit activities than, you know, regular currency or regular natural resources, it's best not to engage with that. Like I said, if you can't prove that, like Rahul said, it's just low-hanging fruit for you to oppose crypto, right? As opposed to really caring about the environment. So I agree. And I think, you know, one thing we can all agree with is as we make a holistic switch to renewable energies and renewable sources of, you know, power, hopefully this concern will also mitigate a little bit. Yeah, thank you for that. So one thing, you know, which I really, really wanted to, you know, get your thoughts on is, look, I think right now the crypto space is it's very, very new, right? Or at least it's gaining traction at this rate. It's a very new phenomenon. So where do you think, you know, in addition to, you know, organizations like Block Tower and Gamma Point, where do you think entrepreneurs and people in general can add the most value going forward to this crypto space?
Yeah. So I think so decentralized finance is basically the killer application for blockchain and crypto, right? So before DeFi is short for decentralized finance. I'm just going to use that from now on. So before DeFi, I think everyone viewed crypto as just this crazy gambling, just casino, volatile asset class, and purely adds no value. It's just people trying to make money and gamble. And blockchain technology was considered just overhyped. People were hyping it up, but it has no practical use case, right? And then DeFi came, right? And DeFi is literally rebuilding these financial primitives ground up, adding tremendous value and bringing in just the smartest minds and talent in technology and finance. And so I think that's where all the action is, right? So I think there's so many startups being built now that are building DeFi protocols, so much venture capital and just like funding capital flowing into this ecosystem and so much innovation happening. And so I think the space to be is in DeFi, right? Whether you want to participate on the investing side or the startup side, there's so much activity and innovation happening there. And it's kind of like one of the coolest areas to be now and really combines just a broad range of stuff from like, you can get as tech savvy and computer science heavy as you want to be to as finance and econ heavy as you want to be, right? It's that entire spectrum. And so we're starting to see a lot of just really high quality and smart talent migrate to this whole decentralized finance ecosystem.
Wow. Yeah, no, that does make sense. And I think that's pretty much where the value truly does lie. Right. So one thing is I wanted to, you know, before we wrap up, just a couple more questions is, I think, you know, something which maybe I should have mentioned at the start while I was doing your introduction is you actually spent your 11th and 12th grade gearing for IIT and stuff. Right. So at Marathi Magnolia, I think the school is, right? Yeah. So that is just insane. I mean, that story is just wild. How many people, guys, tell me, if you're familiar with how Indian, you know, the landscape and colleges and admissions and stuff work, tell me, anyone DM me on Instagram or comment on this video or Spotify, wherever you're listening right now. Tell me, how many people do you know who spent 11th and 12th grade gearing for the Indian Institute of Technology joint entrance examination, which for our non-Indian listeners, look it up. It's a pretty competitive exam, to say the least. How many people do you know that have gone through this, actually cleared it? Okay, that's the craziest part. Actually cleared it and was like, you know what? I'm a dip, head to Wharton, do Morgan Stanley, and get my crypto fund acquired for millions of dollars. I think that is sick, right? So like I said, while that is sick, and it can't be overstated, a lot of people miss the process. A lot of people go like, oh, okay, what? How did Rahul do that? I want to do that, you know? But a lot of people just didn't do what you did in terms of, you know, being obsessed about something, finding something that you're so passionate about that you're working 25 hours a day, 8 days a week for, right? So kind of what would your advice be to, you know, entrepreneurs, maybe younger than you, right? What would your advice kind of be to get to a comparable point to where you are right now? And sorry, yeah. Second question I wanted to ask you is, did that, you know, experience of, you know, being in an IIT focused environment in 11th to 12th, has that translated into any sort of, you know, practical skills for you today?
Yeah. So to answer your first question, right, just about like the whole journey and what kind of really helps to kind of achieve like some amount of success is, I think it's really, and it's, you've already highlighted this, but I think it's just doing stuff you love, right? And so for me, like when I was preparing for IIT, I loved it, right? I actually fell in love with physics.
You don't hear that often. Yeah, you don't hear that often.
Yeah, you don't hear that often. But even my classmates, though, they're just like me. It was like just 10 of us and they're all brilliant. And so I loved it, right? I loved the competition. I loved the challenge. I loved math. I loved physics. I loved chemistry. I really intellectually just fell in love with the whole thing. And obviously there are moments of stress and you're upset about things and disappointment and failure. But that's kind of carried just throughout my life, right? Because after that, I liked physics a lot. And then I saw a lot of parallels between physics and finance, and then kind of really fell in love with finance. And so to me, it's always just, I've just always just been doing what I love and what I'm interested in, right? And this is the kind of stuff that even right now in my free time, I read a lot of physics and like I listen to podcasts about physics, and that's nice. The kind of stuff that just interests me and excites me, right? And so it's really like doing what to others seems like work, but for you is actually play, right? I think that's kind of like the secret to kind of just next level kind of doing like cool stuff, right? And if you're doing work because it's work and you don't like it, there's only so much you're going to do, and there's only in terms of hours and quality, right? And so to really, I think, like build cool stuff and do cool things, it needs to be just stuff you're naturally passionate about. It's not really work. No one's telling you to do it. It's stuff that when you're alone, I think a good test is like, and for me during COVID, right, I was locked like alone in New York, and I spent my whole time just obsessed with crypto and finance. And to me, that's just naturally what I'm interested in, right? So I think that's really just the key, just kind of whatever you naturally love, just pursuing that. And if you don't know what that is, which definitely a lot of people don't, just explore a bunch of different things, right? And you'll find it. Just have like, and just be curious, be open, and read a lot. That's a final thing I'll say. Like I read a ton, and it's a really good habit to get into, because that's where you just start absorbing knowledge and information and identifying patterns and all of that. And so whatever field it's in, just like read as much as you can.
No, absolutely. Wow, thank you. And I'll wrap this up very quick. I won't take more of your time. I know it's almost midnight in Miami right now. But just one last thing, you know, is I wanted to highlight, which I thought was kind of cool when you said, is first off, straight off the bat, if you don't know what you're passionate about yet, if you don't know your calling, you haven't found it, perfectly understandable. Okay, a lot of people our age haven't figured that out. That said, do a bunch of different things, because at the very worst case, you'll know what you don't want to do, right? Which is also valuable in its way. Also, just one thing I wanted to highlight is it's kind of a entrepreneur paradox, right? Is if you think about it, if everyone one day in the world, right, 8 billion odd people started going like, hey, you know what? I found my passion. Let me quit my 9-to-5 and start pursuing this. If everyone did that, right, you wouldn't have a machinery to support the entrepreneurs, right? People doing the grunt work and the 9-to-5 stuff, which I don't know. I thought it's pretty interesting. So, if you're trying to in the future work for a whole lot of gray, don't find your passion yet so you can come work dumb. I'm joking.
So that's but a good one point. I've thought about that, but just to add, yeah, that's a really good point. Cause if everyone, it's kind of like the tragedy of the commons kind of, or right. One of those situations where, or it's like even voting, right? Where this is a bad example, but it's like, if should you vote in an election, right? Your vote actually doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't make sense for you to vote because there's no way your vote's going to influence the election. But if everyone viewed it like that, then the election...
No one's going to vote, yeah. Right?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, I haven't actually... I don't even have to use that, yeah.
No, definitely. I'm glad you thought about it as well. So yeah, just some food for thought, guys. Food for thought before you embark on your entrepreneurial journey, like Rahul and me, respectively. But one last thing I wanted to touch on, and we'll wrap this up, is I think, you know, it cannot be overstated how important both reading and consuming knowledge is. Okay, I just cannot emphasize how important that is. So, and that never stops, because learning is literally a timeless journey. You have, I mean, I'm sure Elon, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, whoever the top three richest dudes in the world are these days, I'm sure all of them have either continue to read an obscene amount or have already read an obscene amount. I don't doubt that for a second. So I wanted to, you know, get your thoughts on two last things. One is, what sort of content/books would you recommend to people, you know, based on, you know, the content and books you've consumed? And second is, what are two areas of content/literature, knowledge, whatever term you want to use, that you want to learn more about going forward?
Yeah. So I'd say, yeah, like I pretty much read anything, right? So I think for me, it's almost, my dad's like this as well. And so like, he's like a voracious reader. And I think I kind of got it through that, but I pretty much like all day, like all I do is read. Like, to me, that's, I prefer that over like watching TV and like most other stuff. Nice. And yeah, so I think, in terms of suggestions, I think they're like different buckets, right? So I think one of the most influential books, and this is cliched, is Sapiens, right? By
Yuval Harari, right?
Yeah, Yuval Harari. And he has, it's a series. So there's Sapiens and then Homo Deus and then 21 Questions. And that was just like an incredible just structure to view like human history and frameworks for understanding like the complexities of modern society. And just viewing it in a very like structural, systematic way. And so that book was just like, I remember I was reading that book and like every other line, I was just like, wow. Like I remember thinking that, I was just like, every other line, I was like, I've never read a book where I'm like, wow, this is wild. So that's one book that was just kind of just pretty life-changing. The other area that I think people should really read about is science. I think science is one of the coolest things on the planet. I've almost re-fallen in like love with it intellectually, because I kind of in college, I kind of really didn't do too much about it. But like now I've like dove in back into like physics and like genetics and evolution and all of that. And so I think maybe I'm trying to think of like the one book people should read in that segment. And it's really tough. But I think A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson, which nice. Basically covers like the history of the universe and covers like all the broad areas of science. There are a lot of other good books so anything by Brian Greene, by Stephen Hawking, those kind of books that really, I think it's very easy to get caught up in day-to-day life. And when you just sit back and think about the fact that the fact that there's this huge universe out there and like the Big Bang happened and all we are is a collection of cells working together, right? And the fact that this incredibly complicated world and universe actually follows simple, beautiful, elegant laws, right? It's really mind-blowing. I think the human mind isn't even designed to think about that too much because we just get caught up in day-to-day. Because from an evolutionary perspective, that makes sense, right? If we're sitting and pondering the universe, we're gonna die, right? For us to survive and reproduce, we need to be caught up in day-to-day and feeding and getting things done. And so, absolutely. But to me, that's the most magical thing. Like, it's if you're like, what's like the one thing that really excites you and drives you the most? It's really just the beauty that like all of this craziness around us can actually, you can understand it and explain it, and it's these beautiful laws and equations that can actually explain so much.
Wow.
So those are the two. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Continue. I didn't mean.
No, I was gonna say. So that's those are kind of the two. Like, I'd say like Sapiens for like great understanding of history and humanity, and then any of these science, popular science fiction books to really appreciate like the grander cosmos and science from a broader perspective. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, I completely agree. Guys, I hope, you know, whoever listening, definitely. I've read Sapiens, you know, I can attest to it, pretty quality book, check it out. And just generally these areas, they're so fascinating. I don't think anybody can debate that, right? I mean, when you really think about it, just how negligible all of us are in the universe. And one thing which I like about what you said is, look, we're in the prime era of conditioning today, okay? In that media is super accessible, influential, the age of the internet, you know, everyone, you know, I'm not the only person in the world of the podcast. There's millions of them, right? So like that, we're getting conditioned based on, you know, different schools of thought. But the one thing that stays kind of constant, right, amidst all this different conditioning is our Darwinian instincts as human beings, right? There are certain things that are non-negotiable. Like, it would take a lot for, say, a mother to stop loving her child because it's literally built into her, okay? For those of you who, have you seen the Ted Bundy documentary by any chance with Zac Efron?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, very, very, just a disclaimer, don't watch it if, you know, you're grossed out easily by true crime. And obviously, he's a very vile and shockingly wicked human being. You'll get it if you've seen the title. But one thing which, you know, even that you know, movie/documentary taught me is even, and this is completely real, you can fact check this to anyone listening, is Ted Bundy's mom appeals to the judge, right? And one thing which he says is so powerful is, you know, a mother should not outlive her child. And this is one of the worst human beings ever, okay? This is objectively just such an awful person. I don't think anybody can, you know, you can't, even she was not defending Ted Bundy, but it was just in her maternal instincts. Whereas, you know, a lot of his friends and, you know, his the girl he was with, they were all like, nah, fam, you crossed too many lines. I don't want anything to do with you. Rot in hell, right? Essentially. Yeah. But that, I think, was just so eye-opening, is that, wow, like there are certain things which, you know, you can really trace back to our animal instincts that will never change, you know, and that's insane.
Have you watched Interstellar?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
so yeah, even that movie, I just noticed, has that same line where at the end of the movie, the hero, what's his name? Matthew McConaughey goes back. Yeah. He like, and then his daughter is aged by then, right? And she had solved that whole puzzle. And then she's like, no father should see their kid die, right?
Yeah,
and it's such a primitive instinct. Yeah. But yeah, Anish, I fully agree, man. Like, one thing I always think about is like, it's sad, right? Like, first of all, evolution as a concept is one of the most powerful theories I've ever encountered, because it's true by itself. It's like such a, you can't disprove it. It's just so fundamentally true. And I've never seen a theory like that you can't, like Newton or anything else, you can have an argument against it, but evolution just has to be true. And because of evolution has shaped all of our minds and thoughts and everything, right? All of this complexity was shaped by evolution. It was almost an algorithm. And so we are a product of that. And that sucks, right? That's almost like our entire brains were brainwashed by this algorithm that has one objective in mind. And so whenever possible, I like to kind of actually step away, like kind of identify those evolutionary instincts or ideas and like step away from that, right? Because that doesn't have to be who you are and that doesn't have to define you. And I actually think there's a lot of meaning in kind of appreciating things at a higher level. I think stuff like music and art and science and like all of those kind of next level stuff is like, to me, one layer above evolution, right? Where you're not like falling into your primal instincts, but you're kind of appreciating something at a much higher level. And that's stuff like that's like the kind of stuff I strive to focus on and spend my time on.
Yeah. No, wow. That's very, very wholesome note, you know, for sure. I completely agree with that though. Right. It is ultimately there's a, you know, the one book, which I would recommend to you if you haven't read yet is Robert Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yeah.
Definitely check that out. Again, to anyone listening to this, check that out. It's a fire book. And one thing, you know, which is so true, kind of what you said is, things like art, things like, you know, knowledge, things like science, music, literature, whatever it is, right? Sport, even for that matter, right? I feel like that's kind of what this whole, you know, simulation, shall we say, is all about, right? Is really kind of, because nobody wants to just exist, okay? People want to live. I strongly believe that. And I think, you know, these are the, you know, best ways to really, really get an appreciation for these kinds of things.
Yep.
But yeah, everyone, I'll also be linking Rahul's, in addition to your blog, I'll be linking your Instagram also. That's cool, right?
Yeah.
Cool. So I'll be linking Rahul's Instagram. I'll be linking Rahul's blog on finance, crypto. Check out whatever content's on there. And yeah, for everyone listening, this episode, it'll be out on all platforms, whatever you listen to podcasts on. The video version on YouTube might take a bit longer from the time you're listening to this right now, but I'll still make sure clips in audio form are still readily available on YouTube. But without, you know, taking more of your time, Rahul, thank you so much, man. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did hosting you. And I sure learned a lot. I hope everyone else listening did. And one last thing before we get Rahul's final thoughts on his take on evolution. I know on every episode of Whole Lotta Grey, I'm always talking about how, yeah, every opinion should be heard. One thing though, if you are a creationist and you're super anti-evolution, definitely DM either me or Rahul. I'm so curious to hear what you have to say, you know? But yeah, thank you, man. Thank you for coming on the show. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me, man. I love this conversation and yeah, glad to be a part of it.